Tony, let's get started with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. The reports show that the average GDP growth of the SCO member states was more than 5% last year. Industrial production grew by 4.5%, and the inflation rate was 2.4. These numbers for these countries are, we can say, are excellent. And how
Certainly.
do you see this organization, and how do you see the importance of these type of organizations?
Well, it's been going since I think 2001, and it's evolved quite a bit over the past 20 or so years. Initially, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization was set up more or less to try and manage border disputes between the different countries in the Eurasian region. And what has happened, and I think largely alongside the growth of China and the very rapid economic growth, it's evolved into, well, if I say security, I don't mean it's a military alliance. Clearly it's not. But there are more discussions among the countries about sorting out any border disputes and issues that arise. I think the core of it is very clearly the big development and boom in Chinese trade, investment, and everything else. And that's been a big benefit also for the regional countries. Actually, earlier today, I put on X, the old Twitter, a diagram showing the overlap between members of the SCO, members of BRICS, and members of China's Belt and Road Initiative. And there's quite a lot of overlap. I mean, there's about 140 or something countries involved in the Belt and Road Initiative, and quite a lot of them are in the Eurasian region. So they already had some kind of cooperation and, say, Chinese investment and trade and everything like this. But what has happened, along with everything else, frankly, in the last 2 years or so, there's been a big acceleration of bilateral trade deals using their own currency much more. And Russia also has played a big role in this, but clearly is much smaller than China in economic terms. So you then have Russia and China, big economic, energy, nuclear power, potential weapon supply, all kinds of raw materials, food and agricultural goods, just a huge real economy kind of backdrop for all of these developments. And no, it's good. The figures you mentioned earlier about the very good growth and developing trade and everything like this. And it's been in spite of all the Western attempts to curb linkages or cause trouble. I think Armenia, for example, is in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And the EU and the US has gone out of its way to get the Armenian government to oppose Russia. And similarly, they've tried things in Georgia, they've tried things all over the region to disrupt things, cause trouble, and everything else. And it works a little bit here and there, but the countries in the region certainly see that if they want to develop economically, this is what they have to do. And the West is not offering anything that's any better, and usually a great deal worse, basically. So I think that this organization, together with the development of BRICS, and you know, China's Belt and Road Initiative, all of these things are intertwined and will continue to be a big development factor for economies working outside of the usual Western influence, you know, the IMF, the World Bank, various things you have to do to get Western investment. So these countries can operate far more independently, and that's what they're doing. So it's very, very positive, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. When we look at the Russia's economy today and the way that they could manage during more than 2 years of the conflict in Ukraine, and we cannot ignore, on one side, we know that the country is so rich in terms of natural resources, but we cannot ignore the role of BRICS, the role of SCO, the role of these initiatives in Belt and Road initiatives, this corridor, transportation corridor, north south from Russia to India. These are big picture of what's going on in Russia and how they could keep these ties, these important ties with members of BRICS.
Yeah, I think what's going to happen, because in a way the BRICS organization got a bit of a wake up call with Argentina dropping out. You know, the previous government in Argentina wanted to join. They got proposed, accepted, and then the new president Milei said, no, we don't have anything to do with this. I think what the BRICS countries will do is something similar to what the Shanghai Cooperation Organization already does, which is you do have full members who, in a way, have signed up for everything, but you also have something called a dialogue member and an observer. So to indicate different levels of closeness to what the organization is trying to do. So I think what's going to happen with BRICS is that they'll, in the coming months, and I think there's in September in Russia, there's a big meeting in Kazan.
October.
October, okay, yeah. That they'll probably propose a whole number of new candidates, but there may not be any actual new full members in the old way of doing things. And instead, they'll probably have this kind of quasi membership. You know, you're an associate member or something along those lines for probably quite a wide range of countries. And then we will see how it develops for those individual countries, whether they get any closer in the following couple of years. But I think that's the kind of thing that's happening, because, you know, you just can't tell, frankly, that if the US tries to organize a coup like in Bolivia, or it tries to do various other things, what might look like a good idea at one time, suddenly you get a completely different government that wants to do the reverse things. So, but the thing is that, there's this old phrase from the Middle East that the dogs may bark, namely the imperialist dogs, but the caravan moves on. So I think that's it. It's continuing, even if you get all this kind of yapping around from Western countries that don't like what's happening.
I think that would be amazing if they suggest a trial version of membership to some states like Turkey. Turkey is asking to be part of BRICS, but we know how tricky is that for BRICS. And with the case of Argentina, you've just mentioned that the new president doesn't want to be part of BRICS. If they put a trial version of membership just to evaluate the performance of the country during a specific period of time, that would be much helpful for BRICS. Yeah.
All right. No, I think I'll just say that it's not entirely clear what they'll do, but there are some comments from some Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs people indicating that this might be something, something like that. And I thought that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization method was pretty good. Because, for example, Belarus, which is more or less a union state now with Russia, it's been in the wings waiting to join the Shanghai Organization for the last several years. But today, I think it was, they finally got, today or yesterday, they finally got the nod of full membership. So, yeah, that would make sense. So, for example, in the case of Turkey, I think there's going to be a few more problems because it's likely that they'll say things like you can't join if you have sanctions, unilateral sanctions against any other member, because it just doesn't make any sense. How can you be part of this club when you're telling me that you don't, you want to ignore or boycott this member? And there's another thing which is a little bit unclear at the moment, but I think it may become clearer that they may well say that you're not allowed to belong to, any military alliance which is opposed to any member. Because the SEO, for example, that's what they do already, essentially, a version of that. They haven't made that absolutely formal, otherwise Turkey wouldn't be in the SEO. But I think they could do something like that for BRICS, and it would put Turkey on the spot as to where they stand with NATO membership. So yeah, there's a number of these things. I say it's actually quite amazing. All of these developments having accelerated in just the last 2 or 3 years. And I wrote about some of this about 10 years ago, and yeah, it was the beginnings, but it looked like a pretty slow process, but it's accelerated dramatically in the past 2 or 3 years, as the objectives of the West have become so much clearer. Their inability to deliver development for a wide range of countries is so much more obvious. And all the politics of it is complicated, but with enough kind of pragmatism, these issues can be sorted out, I think.
How do you see the conflict right now in Ukraine? We've learned that recently Orban was, he visited Zelensky, tried to suggest him a ceasefire before going after negotiations, but it seems that the Zelensky administration rejected this suggestion. Right now they're talking about that Zelensky has some doubts about this ceasefire. But after all, how do you see the current phase of the conflict? Do you find it that the West is getting to the point that negotiations would be the next step, or we're gonna have some new escalations on the battlefield?
Yeah, it's difficult to say because there's no, well, how can I put it? There's no way out for the West which doesn't involve them losing. So they have to work out, and maybe Russia does some kind of thing as well to enable them to lose without it looking too obvious. Maybe, that's one possibility. Because the the way it's going is really getting quite frantic. So if you take the European elections, we may talk about later. Well, what you now have is it looks like von der Leyen in Europe is going to remain the president of the European Commission. And although she is meant to be like the head of the civil service administration, she acts like she's the queen of Europe, basically, and comes out more or less of everything the US would like her to say. Then you have the head of European diplomacy. Instead of Borrell, it's going to be Kaya Kallas, who is a rabid Russophobe. And you have another kind of US puppet, Mark Rutte from the Netherlands, being ahead of NATO. So on the European side, it doesn't look like anything's really going to change regarding Russia-Ukraine. And certainly not in the UK either. There's an election today, but the new government, Labour Party, will do the same things, basically. Alongside that continuity and stupidity on the part of, say, the Europeans, there is also a bit of a problem they have to deal with. Partly, the US looks like it wants to sideline Ukraine. You know, it's giving a bit less money, actually a lot less money. It's still delivering weapons, but not so much. And the US wants to load the burden of Ukraine onto Europe. So that will also be true with Trump. You know, if Trump wins the election, it's, you know, spend your 2% or more on defense, or, you know, you can get lost and do it yourself, that kind of thing. And when it came to funding Ukraine, this new scheme they came up with of, you know, giving them another $40 billion or something like this. This was on the back of stolen money from the Russian central bank, you know, to use the interest income to fund the interest payments on this bond. And the difficulty they have is that if they issue, it's not technically a bond they'll sell in the market, but it's a chunk of money that individual countries have to contribute to. And it's not entirely clear who's going to do it or how much. But it then means there's the liability will be on to the individual Europeans, basically, because it won't really be the US. The US will say we've given enough already. So that's going to put the Europeans in a big jam because they already have big deficits. They already are trying to plan to, you know, boost defense spending and do all kinds of things like this. And it puts the Europeans right at the center of breaking international law regarding property. And the US doesn't really care about that. The US says, oh, it's fine, you can do that, it's not a problem, because it's not the US doing it. So, you know, so there's all this kind of trouble in the background, which will not go away and will just get worse. And at the same time, you have on Russia's strategy in Ukraine, firstly, after the attack of Ukrainian missiles onto that beach in Crimea, in the aftermath of that, you know, where several people got killed and over 150 got injured with these cluster bombs on a damn beach, right? The Russians finally came out. I say finally, they should have done this a long time ago, with some proposals which are not yet clear exactly what they're going to do, but apparently there are proposals to deal with the surveillance drones, the reconnaissance drones in the Black Sea. And they only back in 2022, they did try to stop one of the drones, and they just blasted petrol over it, oil over it, to try and disable it. And the US got very annoyed. But these drones are helping Ukraine target Russian facilities, often civilians, if it's in Belgorod and Kursk, but also in Crimea. There's a lot of Russian civilians are getting killed. And what has happened over the past week, I mean, I don't know this firsthand, but I've seen reports from people who monitor all the aerial flights and things like this. And apparently, in the past week, there haven't been any drones. Because so it shows that NATO realizes that if they do one of these global hawk things going across and doing reconnaissance and signals transmission to the Ukrainians, and okay, if the Russians knock it out the sky, which they could easily do, would this then escalate things and start a war between Russia and NATO? Because technically, the drone would be operating in international waters, in the kind of southern part of the Black Sea. So this would then, I mean, it's pretty obvious why Russia would do that, and it's likely they will. But so far, there hasn't been a test case, if you like, to indicate what would happen. And final point on this, really, and unless you have any other issues, is that Russia's offensive, it looks like it's very slow in terms of new territory taken over, but the impact on the losses of the Ukrainian armed forces have stepped up dramatically. I might have mentioned before when we spoke that, around towards the end of last year, it was 700 a day killed and wounded on the part of Ukrainian armed forces. Rose to about 1,000, then about 1,500. In the last couple of weeks, it's very close to 2,000 every single day. It's just astonishing losses, And a report out this morning was more than 2,000 killed and wounded. And there are more reports of Ukrainian forces of surrendering or giving up or just running away, that kind of thing. So it still looks like a very slow process, but from Russia's point of view at this point, it's an attrition war, slowly grinding down. And because that's been going on for quite some months now, it's had a pretty big impact. And I think it's become clearer to even these Western analysts who go along with all the propaganda. They realize now that things are looking very bad indeed for the Ukrainian war effort. And so they're on a complete loser. And they realize it, but it's a case of how do they handle it politically? So, yeah.
Yeah. Tony, what you talk about, you've mentioned if Trump wins and what would be the impact on this conflict in Ukraine. And they're asking, we know that Trump would ask the European countries to increase their defense budget more than 2.5% of their GDP. And how would that affect the economy of Europe in terms of inflation with the current situation of their economy?
The inflation impact wouldn't be that much, but it will cause quite a bit of trouble for public spending. And especially in France, which has quite a big deficit on its fiscal spending already. And then, most of the other countries, essentially. They could. It's not that they couldn't afford to do it. They could do it if they wanted to, but the political backdrop is far more problematic now. There is the growth of more nationalistic forces, as revealed in the recent elections in Europe. And their views on the Ukraine differ. You know, so you have Meloni in Italy, essentially is on the NATO side and, you know, continue supporting Ukraine, this sort of thing. But still, Italy has a big budget deficit. Does she really want to chip in, here's another 10 billion euros or something, you know, for this at a time when, you know, when people in Italy are thinking, you know, this isn't such a good idea. Germany, similar problem. And the Alliance for Deutschland, the right-wing group in Germany, is far more against giving Ukraine more money. Because a number of these countries, sorry, France is the third one, the National Rally, Le Pen's party. She hasn't quite won, but it looks like, you know, she's not far below enough to form a government. And her party, well, is pro-Zionist, which is very common now among, if your politics are more or less fascist, you often are a Zionist as well, you know. So this is a very strong link among all these. But basically, when it comes to paying for the Ukraine war and the economic losses and everything like this, it's going to cause trouble for the more nationalistically orientated political parties that are now growing in many European countries. So I'd say in principle, they could afford it. If they wanted to do it, yes, they could do it. You know, put more money into defense, so-called, and everything else. But it will lead to more kind of political difficulties that they face when living standards essentially are flat or falling in many of these countries with high inflation and, you know, wages getting held back, this sort of thing.
When you look at the elections in France, do you, with the second party or the second, in the second place, we had a left wing party and above the Macron's party. Mm-hmm. And the question here is in the mind of many people, what does it mean right now in Europe, left wing, right wing? And what are the definitions of these words these days?
Yeah. The term is largely meaningless, actually. And for example, the Social Democrats in Germany were meant to be kind of, they wouldn't have called themselves socialist, you know, along those lines, but, you know, kind of leftish or something. Or the Greens at one point were considered to be, you know, kind of radical environmentalist, everything else. They became the biggest warmongers in Europe, essentially. And in the UK, the UK Labour Party, you know, pro-Zionist, pro-NATO, pro-Ukraine war, all this sort of thing, you know. So this kind of so-called leftism is just frankly meaningless. And I don't really use those terms anymore because it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't explain anything, doesn't say where you stand. And my simple rule of thumb, frankly, is we want to know where you stand on the key international issues of the day is, what do you think about Palestine? What's your view? And if you support Israel in any way whatsoever, then basically the chances of you being a pro-imperialist are getting close to 100%. No doubt there are exceptions, but basically that's an easy kind of test of where someone really stands. And maybe some people are ignorant, they haven't followed the news or read much of the history, but that I think is a simpler way of telling where someone stands regarding, if you like, what you might call progressive forces in the world versus reactionary forces.
And when it comes to the conflict in Taiwan and what's going on right now in Philippines, how problematic is the situation right now in your opinion? We know that Putin was talking about Philippines, and China has concerns about Philippines. And how do you see the situation right now between Russia and China on one side and the United States on the other side, considering what's going on in Philippines and Taiwan?
Well, there's been a big effort, obviously, of the Americans to build up bases in the Philippines and get them to become anti-Chinese. I think this won't last that long. I mean, and under the current political government, it could roll on for a few more years. That's true, but I think the economics of it is so contradictory to that kind of stance that hopefully there'll just be new people who realize this is a stupid thing to do, essentially. But I think essentially, well, the US still has quite a lot of influence in the region. I think Philippines is one of the ASEAN members, Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And if you look at their trade, they're quite important trading partners with China, or important for China, and China is important for them. But the scale of trade between the Philippines and China has already diminished with the political developments in the last couple of years. It's still growing with other countries, say with Vietnam and Malaysia and most of the others, and Singapore and others. But the Philippines is sticking out a bit. And there was an I think there was an incident recently where the Philippines government just lied about what happened. There's meant to be some terrible Chinese thing with a Philippines fishing boat. And it turned out the Chinese Coast Guard was actually rescuing the fishing boat that got into trouble. And but they tried to turn it into some anti-Chinese thing. I mean, I don't know, I wasn't there, but basically from what I've read around the stories there, that was one example of just these endless numbers of little provocations that can occur in the region. And Taiwan is looking for a complete disaster if it wants to cut away from China. There's about a quarter of its trade, imports and exports, are with mainland China. And I remember, actually, it's a long time ago now, something like 20 years ago. Last time I was in Taiwan was with the European bank I was working for. And we were visiting, I think it was a Taiwanese chemicals company, because the bank I was working for was giving them like $200 million loan or more than that for an investment. Guess where the investment was? In China. Just like Foxconn, the big producer and assembler of Apple products, is a Taiwanese company whose main operations have been in China. So there's a huge two-way investment flow, which the US has done its best to try and mess up and cause trouble with, basically. But, you know, there is huge developments there. And I can't remember who mentioned this before, that they, you know, they've tried to get Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, which is one of the biggest chip producers, to move to the US. And it's been big trouble. Basically, they can't find a skilled workforce. The working methods and skills and et cetera that they rely on, it's been problematic to get anything going there, basically, because the US is more involved in commercial parasitism than it is involved in production these days. And you know, so it's fine. You get Apple to do, get everyone else to do your production, and then they take the monopoly profits further down the line, that kind of thing. And you know, it'd be a very stupid thing for Taiwan to continue with, but given the politics of it, they will continue to do it, I think, for a while now.
New polls in Europe show that most of the people in Europe are in favor of negotiations in Ukraine. And when it comes to Germany, France, Italy, and they are mostly in favor of negotiations. On the other hand, we have Estonia, Sweden, United Kingdom, and Poland, Portugal. They are much in favor of the continuation of the conflict. How we can interpret this poll in terms of their policy and the changes that are happening in Europe, in your opinion? Is it going, we've learned that Le Pen in France is going to make a coalition with Orban in the European Parliament. What's the meaning of these type of changes that are happening right now?
It's called something like a patriotic movement or something like that, I think, that Orban is trying to set up. I think with Czech Republic and also Austria, that was one story I read a week or so ago. I wasn't sure where Le Pen stood in relation to that, but it's entirely possible that, you know, a right-wing bloc of some sort gets together in, you know, for the European Parliament. The problem they face, even if they set something like that up, is that the political superstructure, if you like, is more in control of US orientated leaders like von der Leyen. And also now with Kaja Kallas of Estonia, not yet anyway, it might be in a few weeks' time, that she could become the replacement for Borrell. And they will continue what they've been doing. You know, it's undemocratic and not what people want if you do any of these opinion polls, as you mentioned, but that's what they will do, basically. And I don't really see an easy way for getting that stopped. It's possible that these right-wing groups, and again, an indication that left and right doesn't mean anything these days, it is possible that they will want to stop it. And maybe they could, to a degree. But it's hard to see how. I don't see how the mechanism kind of works, because the European Parliament, under the von der Leyen regime of the previous years, didn't seem to have that much of a role. And he had the only noises I was seeing coming out to oppose all this was from two Irish MEPs. I've got her name, Claire. I can't remember her other name, and her colleague, both from Ireland. They were the ones who were always opposing this, but they got voted out, unfortunately, in the latest European elections. So yeah, Claire Daly, that's her name, yeah. And I can't remember her colleague's name, but they got voted out. And I don't think there's that many people who would stand up in the same kind of principled way to oppose all the crap that the European elites have done, whether it be supporting Israel and Gaza and all the genocide, or whether it be the Ukraine war. So, yeah, the mechanism of political control and what actually happens is not something that's based upon opinion polls. In the end, if it looks like, people are rioting in the streets all over the place, well, they would have to take some kind of notice. But it hasn't really got to that yet.
Right now, they're talking about Ukraine joining the EU, the European Union. What would be the effects of this type of movement on the part of the European Union? And how does that affect their economy, in your opinion?
It's a dream that they keep having to offer Ukraine to keep the show on the road, but just laughable, frankly. The Ukrainian economy is a bankrupt disaster. The only thing it's really got going for it is pretty fertile agriculture. And the problem is that that was already very undeveloped. And it could, say, for example, magic wand, Ukraine joins the EU next year or something like that. If it did, that would wreck European agriculture. And not simply in Poland and, say, Hungary and surrounding countries. It would wreck it in Germany and in France. So it's not going to happen, basically. And the only way it would not quite wreck European agriculture is because Ukraine's agriculture is already being wrecked by the war. And most of the land, fertile land, is actually owned by European asset managers, BlackRock and people like this. There isn't going to be this magic wand to make Ukraine join the EU in the next year or two. And the EU has many, many rules that you're meant to follow before you get closer on this journey to join. And it's nowhere near any of these, And Zelensky has cancelled elections. You have a whole bunch of fascists running the show in Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. And, it's obviously at war, and a war that it's losing. So, I don't see, even in 5, 10 years' time, that Ukraine would ever join the EU. But they keep this ticking over as a prospect, and especially people like von der Leyen do, because they know they don't really have to do it. Just have to keep the prospect ticking over because they want the war to continue to weaken Russia and, hopefully not lose themselves, which they are losing, and they don't want to admit.
Yeah.
So, I think it's a complete fantasy,
We know that Ukraine has received a $2.2 billion tranche from the IMF, And the problem is that by the end of the year, Ukraine has to repay the IMF $1.9 billion. And how do you put these two together? We know most of the money that they're giving to Ukraine goes to the pocket of the military industrial complex. At the same time, they have to repay 1.9 billion. It doesn't match. It doesn't. How we can understand this?
Well, this is where this amazing facility of stealing 3 or 4 billion dollars worth from Russia's assets to, finance Ukraine's deficits. I don't know quite how they're going to do it, but one report I was reading recently said, I think it's sometime in August, that unless there is a restructuring, and not simply IMF money, this is all the other money that they've borrowed, unless there's a restructuring, Ukraine will actually be in default. So they'll make an effort to steal even more of Russia's money to probably pay that in some fashion. But technically, it will be in default. According to the usual rules, which of course are no longer followed, no more money would be lent, etc., and all this kind of thing. So it's a big financial headache, but it's one that the G7 in its infinite wisdom, and the US and the EU will try and do something to get around. But yeah, the country is bankrupt. It depends upon endless money to finance its corruption. I think that there's a story recently that Zelensky's wife recently bought a Bugatti for about $4 million or something like this, So this, they can't really openly admit it because it's too embarrassing. But this cannot go on for much longer. But it's hard to see quite when it's going to stop, because it will be a PR disaster for NATO, a PR disaster for the European Union, a PR disaster for the UK, for the US, etc. So the show must go on, basically. And I think it's just going to have to be a more open military collapse that will bring the show to an end. And that could happen by the end of the year. You can't put much money on any of my predictions, but basically, everything looks like by the end of the year, all of these forces will come together and just make it completely unsustainable for things to continue as they have been.
Only shifting the gear to the conflict in Gaza, how do you find the economy of Israel? And is their economy capable of surviving the way that they're doing right now without Turkey, without Saudi Arabia, without these countries who are Azerbaijan, who are so important for their economy?
Well, Turkey, Azerbaijan, and a bunch of the others have up until recently been supporting Israel quite a lot. And some people who follow shipping transfers, it seemed to be that, there was still, despite Erdogan in Turkey indicating, oh, yes, we stop. But it was, yes, we stop in a few months' time. It's always something like this. And basically, some of the transfers of goods were done from Turkey to somewhere else and then ending up going back to the port of Haifa or something like this. But it's still having a big impact on the Israeli economy. To get proper data on this is very difficult. But what did happen just a couple of days back was that the port of Eilat in the south declared bankruptcy. And some other information, I tried to get the data on this and couldn't find it, but apparently it's in Israeli newspapers and a couple of reputable sources, including something from an Israeli newspaper, indicated that 500,000 people who have dual passports, you know, for elsewhere in Europe or the US, they've exited the country. And it's causing real problems because more and more local people don't want to join the Israeli armed forces and get involved in anything more in Gaza, and certainly not for any potential open war with Hezbollah in Lebanon. You know, they're suffering much more than they're used to suffering because the Hamas and the Al-Qassam brigades, if I got the name right, are fighting back much more than they're ever used to facing. And Hezbollah could cause them big trouble indeed. So no wonder the economy is in a mess. Society is in a big mess. But when you have a Zionist project that is so used to lying, getting endless unquestioned support from the US and from the West in general, they've got generations of people, frankly, who up until recently thought this could go on forever. You know, you want to kill some Palestinians? Go ahead. You want to murder people? Go ahead. If you want to have Israeli snipers killing kids on the border with Gaza, go ahead and do it. If you want to murder people on the beach, no problem. You know, so all of this shit that has been occurring for many, many years, but with the events in Gaza, it's made Israel toxic in political terms. It hasn't changed that much in overall political terms from a government point of view. So you won't find the UK changing its mind. You won't find, you know, von der Leyen and friends in Europe changing their minds either. But it's clearly not working, and it's clearly becoming big trouble and leading to all kinds of things with, you know, the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice at the UN. So all of this is continuing, and it's becoming embarrassing, even for the US. You know, Donald Trump has gotten enough money from, you know, Zionist pro-Israel funders that probably that won't stop. You know, Donald Trump, who changed the embassy location from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So again, can't expect much really to change, even if there's, you know, Trump number two in November when there's the US elections. But still, it's not something that they could easily live with, and it further undermines any US standing. You know, I mean, the US standing has been going down the toilet for a long time now, and especially with the genocide in Gaza. And the genocide in Gaza continues in the West Bank as well, not simply in Gaza. But you're starting to see more signs that maybe Russia and China will do something that they haven't really done before. And there have been reports of Russia possibly giving anti-ship missiles to the Yemen armed forces. It's strictly speaking wrong to call them Houthis. More technically correct, call them Ansarallah, and they have been brilliant and successful and made complete fools of the US, NATO, etc., etc. And I was looking at some figures the other day that are from the UN, sorry, the IMF, I think it is. They do a port watch. And despite this effort by this US thing called Operation Prosperity Guardian, it's been a big mess. And the Yemenis, as of even last week, they've stopped 75% of the traffic in the Red Sea. And the remaining 25% is mainly Russian and Chinese ships, because they are not going to Israeli ports. And there's also been attacks on Haifa. So apart from Eilat, which is not a very big port anyway, but Eilat has declared bankruptcy because no ship has visited anymore. So you've got Haifa and one or two other ports on the Mediterranean coast, but they are being more targeted by Hezbollah and by the resistance forces in the rest of the region. So the Israelis are in big trouble. They will depend more and more on political, military, financial support, which is becoming a bit more difficult on the part of the West. It hasn't stopped, and it will continue, but it's not as easy as it was before.
Yeah. When you look at the, just to wrap up this session, when you look at the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, recently they have offered a defense treaty to Saudi Arabia in order to normalize in their relationship with Israel. But we know that Saudi Arabia, it seems that they're moving toward the east, toward Russia and China, and they stopped that agreement for 50 years. They had petrodollar agreement with the United States, and right now that's gone. They don't want to extend that agreement with the United States. How do you see, how we can understand the behavior of Saudi Arabia at this particular moment?
Well, there was a deal back in 1974, set up by the US. It wasn't a technical treaty which lasted 50 years and stopped a few weeks ago or whenever. It was more of a security agreement, and it was part of the petrodollar deal of pricing oil in US dollars. And it's true. most oil is priced in US dollars. But as I say, it wasn't some kind of treaty that finished at the end of 50 years, and now it doesn't operate anymore. And that's just a fantasy. That wasn't the case. Because for the last couple of years at least, Saudi Arabia has been pricing oil in Chinese renminbi for the Chinese. Even United Arab Emirates has been selling oil to the Chinese in local currencies. So this has been going on for a while, not simply the last few weeks, not simply since this so-called treaty, deal, whatever it is, finished. And it's growing much more. And the SCO we were talking about at the beginning, and regional countries are doing much more to try to get, even if it's bilateral, try to get local currency deals between, the Saudi Riyal, the United Arab Emirates currency, and any other currency in trade deals. So, and all of this is happening, whatever the US wants to do about it. And the Saudis have come out quite openly and with a formal document that you can find, I've got a copy of it, the thing of basically saying, we want a Palestinian state, we want recognition of Palestine, etc., etc. That's even the Saudis, who've been traditionally, in this very close relationship with the US. So even they're doing it quite openly. And all of the economics tells them they're not going to have Mohammed bin Salman's plan to develop the Saudi economy through the US. It's going to be China, it's going to be the SCO, it's going to be BRICS. All of this, not the US, not Europe, certainly not the UK. And even the weapons are not really going to be that effective, really. And especially if you have better relationships with Iran, brokered by China, Russia, and the whole BRICS setup. And especially if you even get some kind of settlement over Yemen and you get all these other things, right? So the geopolitics of a Western scheme, of a pro-Israeli scheme, of an anti-Palestinian scheme, doesn't work anymore. They won't come out and say, we will support Palestine openly, and we will, we will attack Israel or something like this. They won't do this, but they will do more or less everything else to undermine the position of the Zionist state. And that's quite apart from whether there is actually a military attack on these fuckers, as there needs to be, basically. So it's not looking too good. And it's down to a decline of Western power. It's down to growing panic in all kinds of ways. So basically, I think this is finally getting into the end game for the Israelis. And it causes them to panic, and it causes them to be even more brutal and genocidal than they have been already. But it's causing them ever more political trouble and even embarrassment on the part of the Americans and the Europeans. So it's not over, unfortunately, and many more Palestinians are dying. But it's getting closer to be over.